Offering our most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. As always, coming to you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Brother Arvind. Before all else, very warm Dashara greetings to all of you. The Dashara celebrations, which is a very, very important part of the calendar of Sanatan Dharma, and more importantly, the calendar of Prashanthi Nilayam, has just commenced. Of course, the real celebration starts with the Veda Purusha Saptah Jnana Yajna, which will start, I think, day after tomorrow. But nevertheless, the festival has begun and we are very happy to join you on this beautiful occasion. Among the many things that happens during Dashara in Prashanthi Nilayam, I think Swami has even spoken about it, where he says one of the things is you take up the study of the scriptures or the Upanishads or any one particular scriptural text in that sense. Because Swami would say that most of these auspicious occasions which are marked by festivals are very conducive for any deep learning, especially for one's spiritual progress. So Swami would say one of the things that you take up during this period is the study of some scriptural text. And as part of that, of course, we would have the Vidwan Mahasabha, where you have scholars talking about some of these deep concepts. But for us, I think what is the most valuable of scriptural texts is Swami's own words. And I think there is no endeavor more holier than trying to understand as deeply as possible what Swami has spoken to us. And I think this week's episode is going to be one such effort, because among the many, many things that Swami says, I think a lot of it we are still grappling with, we are trying to understand. There's one statement which Swami would make so very often, which probably we have never completely come to terms with and understood. That's one of the statements that we're going to take up today. That's going to be the theme of today's satsang. But before I introduce that particular axiom which Swami would so often quote in his discourses, let's invite Brother Arvind to join all of us. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem, and Sairam to all our listeners. Thank you, Prem, for leaving the suspense for me. I will reveal the statement that Swami would often make. The statement is, the proper study of mankind is man. And this statement has been enigmatic for me for many reasons. And one of the reasons is that any time that Swami made use of this statement, he would follow it up like he always does with an explanation of the statement. And there are multiple explanations Swami would give to the same statement. Therefore, I would wonder, what is the actual meaning of this statement? The proper study of mankind is man. You know, looking at it from an English grammar point of view, the proper study of mankind is man. Means man is the proper study of mankind. Which means it felt like if you study mankind, which I assumed is history, if you study the history of mankind, you'll understand man. And I thought that this statement actually means if you study the world history, you will get to know the reason why man is in the position that he is in today. And possibly because, you know, they say history repeats itself. Therefore, man also repeats the same mistakes, repeats the same kind of, response or reaction to situations. And that's why if you study the history, if you study mankind so far, you will be able to better understand man. Now, this is what would happen at a quite fast pace inside my head, even as Swami would say the proper study of mankind is man. But then after that, whatever Swami would say, it would appear to me as if that it's not at all in sync, you know, not at all in sync with what's going on in my head, I mean. So it is obvious that what's going on in my head is wrong, because whatever Swami is saying is perfectly in sync. And dear listeners, it was only recently that I discovered some sort of a sync between the statement, the proper study of mankind is man, and the different kinds of interpretations that Swami gives for this statement. And it makes such beautiful sense now. And let me reveal the little key that actually paved the way opened the doors towards better understanding of what Swami is saying with this statement, the proper study of mankind is man. And the key is the fact that this statement is actually one of the lines from a poem written and published by Alexander Pope in 1733-1734. And since it's a line from a poem, that's why it should not be read prosaically. You know, it should not be read like the proper study of mankind is man. In the context of the poem, when we read it, we understand that the actual prosaic way to present this statement would be, the proper study of man is what the world or mankind would be like. And therefore, if you want to understand the world, you have to understand man. That is how it interprets itself. And there's a great, there's a lovely history behind this statement. There is a lovely, there are many thoughts associated with this statement. And it will be our humble endeavor and attempt today to try to delve into the historical perspective behind this statement. And then, of course, get the juicy meaning that Swami gives us in different varieties for the same statement.
It's a very, very important statement. And in fact, the reason why I also corrected you when you said 19, because the year in which it came, or rather the time in which it came, was also very, very important. And I mean, as you're saying, so many of us very often misunderstand this particular statement which Swami makes. It is misunderstood from the point of view from where it is coming. You know, it wouldn't be wrong, because Swami would also say that, you know, just like as you were saying, whenever I would read or listen to this statement, in fact, I've quoted it in that sense also, saying that this is how I actually look at it. Because as you're saying, when Swami says that, you know, you look at history, when you study history, especially of the rise and fall of great leaders, you know, when they start, how they are, what is their thinking process, and when they start gaining power, when they start gaining popularity, what happens to their mindset after that? When you observe and read all of these things, you understand yourself better. So the proper study of mankind is what leads you to the proper study of man, is what I would think of it as you rightly put it. You know, the study of history makes you, help you understand who man is better.
The current context of man also.
It is true in a sense, and in fact, Swami also does that. You know, that is the reason why you read epics, that is the reason why you read Mahabharata and Ramayana, so you can understand the way the mind of man works. But oftentimes when Swami would use this statement, Swami would always attach it to something like, that is why I say you should have unity of thought, word, and deed. You know, something we'll come to later. So if you're looking at this statement as you have to study history to understand man, this unity of thought, word, and deed actually has no connection to what, you know, what understanding that you've got, right? But it is connected. But for that, you'll have to look at it from Swami's point of view. And very, very interestingly, every time Swami quoted it from the context in which it was written by Alexander Pope. And that's the beauty of it. And it's only when we went back and read the original poem, I think, dear listeners, we realized that Swami was every time, I think in a sense, honoring that poet or that author of those lines, saying that he had the right attitude, he had the right thinking.
Perspective
of, you know, how you have to go about with life. And so Swami was quoting it in the perfect context in which the poet himself had composed it.
In fact, this is from a poem that is titled An Essay on Man. It's an essay on man, but it's a poem on man actually. and that's where actually the key lies. We think that it's a statement from an essay and therefore look at it prosaically, but it's actually a line from a poem, as I stated earlier. So this essay on man was published by Alexander Pope in 1733-1734. And it is said 1733-1734 because when he published it, actually he remained anonymous. Nobody knew who has written this poem. It's only later that he accepted that it was he who had penned it down. So this was an effort on his part to rationalize, or rather vindicate, the ways of God to man. It is concerned with the natural order God has decreed for man. His idea is that because man cannot know God's purposes, he cannot complain about his position in the great chain of being. The great chain of being is his phrase or term that he uses to denote the universe or the world. And he says that You cannot complain that what God is doing is wrong or something can be done better because I don't know what is God's actual purpose. In other words, he said that we must accept that whatever is right. That's all. So whatever is, meaning whatever the present circumstances, it is right. It is perfect. If I am finding a fault in that, I'm not entitled to find a fault in that because I don't know what is God's purpose. So this is the basic crux of the poem. I think possibly we can proceed with our discussion after just reading out a couple of paragraphs from the same poem.
I think it's most of these 17th and 16th century poems are actually like epics. Like
yes,
I think
pages and pages long.
Paradise Lost, it's huge. It runs into many, many pages. And I think there's just two paragraphs from that which speak about these two lines. So we'll just read out those two paragraphs and let's see how much we can understand from that. So yep. This is how it goes. Know then thyself, presume not God to scan. The proper study of mankind is man. Placed on this isthmus of middle state, a being darkly wise and rudely great, with too much knowledge for the skeptic side, with too much weakness for the stoic's pride. He hangs between in doubt to act or rest, in doubt to deem himself a god or beast, in doubt his mind or body to prefer, born but to die and reasoning but to err. Alike in ignorance his reason such, whether he thinks too little or too much, chaos of thought and passion all confused, still by himself abused and disabused. Created half to rise and half to fall, great lord of all things, yet a prey to all. Sole judge of truth, in endless error hurled, the glory jest and riddled of the world. Go, wondrous creature, mount where science guides. Go, measure earth, weigh air, and state the tides. Instruct the planets in what orbs the run. Correct old time and regulate the sun. Go, soar with Plato to the empyreal sphere, to the first good, first perfect, and first fair. Or tread the mazy round his followers trod, and quitting sense call imitating God. As Eastern priests in giddy circles run, and turn their head to imitate the sun. Go, teach eternal wisdom how to rule, then drop into thyself, and be a fool. So this is the poem. I know it's, I think much of it, like all poems which we have read in our college days and school days, it's not easy to understand. It's not like a passage which you can completely understand, but it's very, very beautifully written. In fact, it was very, very well received and much acclaimed at that time for two reasons. I think one of the things I read about this particular essay is this was after the time when The Paradise Lost was written by
Milton.
John Milton, right? So the idea of that poem was that you cannot even begin to comprehend God's plan. Or it's almost like asking man to accept his extreme inferiority and don't even try to understand, what is God's plan. And I think in a sense, Alexander Pope's this poem says that it is not that you should give up to trying to understand God's plan because you're inferior. It's because to preoccupy yourself with trying to understand yourself is a better thing to do than to go after trying to understand God's plan. And that tweak in a perspective which he gave was something which was missing in John Milton's, according to some of the people who are critical about The Paradise Lost. And that's why they said that, yeah, this is what was missing. This is what is the perspective which is going to be helpful.
And, this work, more than any other work, popularized the optimistic philosophy throughout England and the rest of Europe. That's what happened. And here when they say optimistic philosophy, it is different from optimism that we generally talk about. The optimistic philosophy, generally when we say optimism, it just means that don't worry, hold on, things will work out fine. My circumstance will improve. Right now it is bad, but in time or in due course of events, it'll all be fine. That is optimism, as we generally understand it. But optimistic philosophy is different. It it is a philosophical idea that perhaps in ways that may or may not be fully comprehended, the present moment is in an optimum state. In other words, the present is perfect. Unlike optimism, which says that right now things are bad, they will improve, the optimistic philosophy says that this is the perfect state that one could possibly be in at this point in time. So therefore, there's nothing that it will improve or something. This is the best. It is the optimum state. It is the perfect state. So there is a difference between the word optimism, the way we understand it, and the optimistic philosophy. This optimistic philosophy almost borders on what Swami tells us true surrender is. Swami says surrender means, irrespective of what happens to you, close your eyes and tell yourself, this is for my good. God is doing for my good. And accept it, celebrate it. You know, whatever happens, it might be good or bad in our perspective, but it is always for the ultimate good. And that is what this optimistic philosophy is about, and that is what this poem stands for. Because it says that man, you have become, in fact that stanza that you read out, the second stanza, it says that man, you have become very arrogant. Man has used science to understand many things, and therefore he thinks that he is a pseudo god. But it says that you have understood nothing. Therefore, you know, it tries to build in humility in the being and says that this is not what you have to understand. How much ever you go and understand the world, the trees, the forest, the space, you would not have understood anything until and unless you try to understand yourself. That's why that statement comes, the proper study of mankind is man. In the poetic manner, it just means that the proper study of man is what entire mankind is about. The entire world is about, the entire universe is about. You have to seek that knowledge within you and search yourself. Except that you are doing everything else and you are thinking you are God, you are sadly mistaken. That is what the poem tells and tries to build some humility in man, who possibly at that point in time, because of multiple frontiers of science expanding, had begun to grow arrogant.
Right. So in putting it in simple terms, if somebody is still wondering what is this proper study of mankind is man, I think from what we've discussed itself, two things are understandable. One is the suggestion that what needs to be studied is man. As mankind, as a race, if we need to study something, it is the study of man. As Swami would say, you should know yourself. That is what is more important. Not the exploration of the world around is important because it gives you physical comfort. Swami would say that science is not bad. Science has improved convenience. Science has helped us. It is not bad, but the knowledge of science is not going to improve you as an individual. It's only the knowledge of the self which is going to improve. So one of the suggestions he's making is, if anything needs to be studied, it is man. Mankind has to make themselves busy with studying man. And the other suggestion which probably can be thought of is, when you say the proper study of mankind is man, how much ever as a race, as a humankind, we understand man and man's nature, that will be the progress of humankind. Our collective understanding of who man is and what is man's purpose is what will be the collective wisdom of mankind.
While quoting it, of course, we have to say the proper study of mankind is man. But for understanding purposes, because as I said, it has been written in a poetic format. And also, it is archaic English. It's not modern English. It is the English of the 1730s. Therefore, I think if I am not going too far in my suggestion, we can make a small tweak for our understanding. This statement can be read as, the proper study for mankind is man. Then, you know, all the confusion goes away, just to understand it. The quote is actually, the proper study of mankind is man. But for our understanding, we can take it as, the proper study for mankind is man. Meaning man should be the subject of our study. And if we understand man, we can understand mankind. If we understand man, we can understand everything. The secret to understanding everything is to understand man. And so, let's begin our journey in trying to understand what is this man that we have to understand about.
And clearly you can understand, you know, with the nature of the poem, we can clearly understand why Swami was absolutely, he did not hesitate in quoting this so many times, because that is Swami's message. Swami would often say that, you know, you should preoccupy yourself with the study of yourself. Maybe we'll start with one small discourse clip where Swami reiterates this, that the only thing worthwhile knowing is to know oneself. And then even this statement, though it sounds very simple, and probably we could say that we can end the satsang with that, it would help us in going further into it, because as we said, it is not merely about the Advaitic knowledge, just to know about the supreme knowledge alone, but understanding man's role in society, understanding man's one individual lifetime in one's journey, even that becomes understanding yourself, as well as understanding yourself in the entire scheme of the creation. All of that goes into understanding yourself. So first we'll listen to this discourse clip. This was delivered by Swami on 23rd of May 1973. So we'll listen to that first.
Tananu tanu telusukonaka enni vicharanalu manamu chesinappatikini idi kevalamu oka kalamunu vyartaparichinatunte varame avutami kani mana janmanu sarthakam cheyinchukunna varam kaamu.
Without knowing who you are, without knowing yourself, whatever you may do in your life, whatever achievements you may have, you will only have wasted your life. You would not have spent your life in any purposeful manner.
Prapancham nundi yavat anni moolala nundi kudanu prasarinchetvanti yokka patrakala yokka news nu maatrame manam chudadaniki prayatnam chestunnamu. ఏ దేశములో ఏ వ్యక్తి ఏ మార్గములో ఏ విచిత్రమైన ఏ చిత్రమైన ఏ దుఃఖమైన ఏ ఆనందమైనటువంటి విషయాలు ప్రసరిస్తారో అనేటువంటి దీని లోపల మనము అన్ని విధమైనటువంటి వార్తలు వినడానికి మాత్రమే మనము సంసిద్ధులమై ఉంటున్నాము. కానీ అన్ని వైపుల నుంచి వచ్చేటువంటి న్యూస్ లోపల నీవు జీవితాన్ని అంకితం చేస్తున్నావు, కానీ నీ లోపల నుంచి కూడా నువ్వు వచ్చేది న్యూసెన్స్ అనేటువంటిది నీవు అర్థం చేసుకోవటం లేదు.
You are spending all your time in reading newspapers which come from different parts of the world and which bring news from different parts of the world. You are anxiously waiting every day to see these newspapers and to find out what an individual in some part of the world or another individual in some part of the world is producing some happy thing or some sorrowful thing, is doing something great or is doing something small. All the time you are looking for news that is coming from outside, from everywhere in the world, but you are not realizing that what comes from within yourself to you is something which is first to be realized, and that is the most important news.
Kanuka ee jagatte oka newspaper, ee jagatte anetunte newspaper nu okka turi manam chuchamu chaalu. Newspaper vachinappudu మొదటి నుంచి కడ వరకు కూడా చూస్తామే, కానీ చూచిన పేపర్ నే నిత్యము చూడడానికి ఏ యొక్క మూర్ఖుడు కూడా నువ్వు పూనుకోడు.
దిస్ వరల్డ్ ఈజ్ లైక్ ఎ న్యూస్ పేపర్. వి సీ ఎ న్యూస్ పేపర్ ఓన్లీ వన్స్. యూ కెన్ రీడ్ ది న్యూస్ పేపర్ ఫ్రమ్ ది బిగినింగ్ టు ది ఎండ్, బట్ నో వన్ విల్ రీడ్ ది సేమ్ న్యూస్ పేపర్ ఎ సెకండ్ టైమ్ ఆర్ అగైన్ అండ్ అగైన్.
కనుక ఈ ప్రపంచం అనేటువంటి న్యూస్ పేపర్ ను మనం వచ్చాము చూచాము, అంతే. తిరిగి ఈ న్యూస్ పేపర్ అనేటువంటి దాన్ని నిత్యము చూడడానికి మనం ప్రాకులాడకూడదు. నేడు న్యూస్ పేపర్, రేపటి దినం వేస్ట్ పేపర్.
వీ హావ్ కమ్ ఇన్ టు దిస్ వరల్డ్ ఈజ్ అ న్యూస్ పేపర్. వీ హావ్ సీన్ దిస్ న్యూస్ పేపర్ వన్స్. వీ షుడ్ నాట్ అగైన్ అటెంప్ట్ టు సీ ది సేమ్ న్యూస్ పేపర్ అగైన్. A newspaper is a newspaper today, but tomorrow that newspaper becomes a waste paper.
కనుక
well, you know, in that discourse, Swami makes it so clear that whenever we are trying to find out about the world, that knowledge is useful today, but it becomes useless tomorrow. And if we examine human history, that is what has happened. What was considered as a breakthrough knowledge or a breakthrough discovery or invention, a few decades down the line, it's useless and nobody even talks of it. And now the innovation, technological growth is so fast that things are becoming obsolete even faster than it happened before. If things would take 100 years to become obsolete 100 years ago, today they take only 10 years to get obsolete. That is how it happened. That's how fast obsolescence, that's the word, is it? is happening. And we definitely might reach a time where there are some things that become obsolete, like the newspaper. Useful today, but tomorrow they are waste paper. Swami is questioning there, what is the use of gaining that kind of a knowledge which after some time becomes obsolete? And though he doesn't state it in those words, it is evident that Swami is asking all of us, listeners, don't you want to gain that knowledge which never becomes obsolete? And in one statement, actually, Swami summarized it, and that is the knowledge of the self. That has never been obsolete from the times of Krishna, Rama, Buddha, Jesus, to Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, Vivekananda, whatever. Even to this day, it is as fresh, as new, and as relevant as ever. And therefore, Swami says, you have to have that self-discovery. And in the sense, you see, this is also the kind of optimistic philosophy, because when we feel that the times are getting bad, times are getting worse from before, it is not so, because even now, the time is ripe to gain that kind of absolute knowledge, gaining which there is no need to gain any other knowledge. So therefore, the perfect present moment is perfect. Swami would often give the example of how there is a tree from which a seed comes, and that seed grows into another tree. One tree is the tree of the past, one tree is the tree of the future, but Swami would say the most important is the seed. Because the seed is the connection between the two trees. The seed has the past in it, and the seed also has the future in it. And therefore, instead of focusing on the trees, focus on the seed. And in that context, Swami would say, past is past, future is uncertain, present is a present. That's why, you know, it's called present, because it's a gift. And Swami would say, it is not ordinary present, it's omnipresent. Meaning, you know, I was just thinking one day, to whom do we give the, use the adjective omnipresent? To God. So if Swami is saying that the present is omnipresent, it directly means that the present is divine. It is divine, and therein lies the secret to discover. And that is why this optimistic philosophy, because every moment that we are living in is divine. And we have to gauge this. But how do I see this, you know? Like when we were discussing the optimistic philosophy says that the present is optimum. It's in the most perfect state. Now, when I am suffering from terrible gastrointestinal problems, or if I am suffering from an amputated leg, or if I am suffering financial distress, or if I am suffering a distress in a relationship, how can I tell that this is the most optimum solution? How can I say that this is the most optimum situation? Because I can definitely envision a situation that is better for me. It doesn't feel like the optimum situation because possibly my viewpoint or my perspective of viewing is wrong. I'm viewing it from an individual standpoint, which has to be changed in order for us to embrace this the philosophy of optimism.
From what you were saying, there are two ways of looking at it. One is the very beautiful point that you made, that Swami refers to the present as a seed. The present is the most important thing, and it is important because it's the seed for the future. Now, oftentimes when we look at our health problem and you say that, oh, I'm having this problem, as you rightly said, how can this be an optimum situation when I'm in pain? Right? That moment may not be optimum in that sense, but because the moment contains the seed for the future, that might be the optimum thing. Right? Mm-hmm. A seed in itself does not have the leaves and the fruit. But because the seed is the past of the fruit of the future, that is what makes it state optimum. So it is in that sense that, you know, I think today Science Pairs has a very beautiful quote where Swami says one of the greatest wisdoms or Sanatan Dharma gives is that it tells you that you are on a journey. That is the greatest wisdom it is giving you, greatest piece of information it is giving you. It says that you are on a journey, and this life is just one leg in that journey. And you're traveling from birth to birth, finally going to merge in the ocean, which you are a part of as a wave. Right? So he's saying that this is the fundamental wisdom that Sanatana Dharma is giving. If you deny this, you're going to be in pain. Right? It's not going to affect anybody else. You're going to be in pain. Right? So the two ways of seeing that, looking at our present situation and trying to figure out where we are standing. One is to understand that as an individual, this is a much longer journey, and I'm in one, you know, one pinprick in that entire journey. And the other thing is, I am not an individual. There is this huge scheme of things in which I am just one component.
One part.
Right? There are two things of that. Your philosophical journey in that sense, or spiritual journey in that sense, and your presence as a physical entity in this larger scheme of things, which is also physical. not talking about the spiritual aspect, even physically when you're looking at the world, what is the context of your physical existence, right? And that is the second part, both of which have to be understood as we, because the more you understand the concept of mankind or where mankind stands, better you will be as a man or better you will be as a person.
Absolutely. To be able to see in this manner, you know, to be able to see the ultimate good in what is, because, you know, that is the statement from the essay on man. The statement is, whatever is right. In order to be able to see in this manner, you, as you said, the second part, you cannot see it from an individual standpoint, but we have to see it from a holistic point of view. For instance, you know, if there is a cell in the human body and it is being targeted by X-rays and gamma rays and different rays and it's being destroyed, the cell will wonder, how is this good? You know, what is happening? It's all going wrong. How can this be the perfect moment? But you know, if you start zooming out and start seeing the huge picture, now imagine if that cell is a cancerous cell and in order to save the human body, that cell is being destroyed. From an overall point of view, it feels absolutely fine. If that is happening to my hand, say, I am undergoing either radiation therapy or chemotherapy to destroy some cancerous cells in some part of my body, though I know that my body is being destroyed and I'm having to face so many side effects, be it hair fall, be it loss of appetite, be it weakness, so many things. I know that it is physically damaging my body, and yet I'm willingly going through it. Why? That is because I'm looking at it from a more holistic point of view. I know that right now I'm having digestive problems, right now I'm having vomiting, right now my hair is falling off, right now this is happening, right now the cell is being destroyed, but for my body it is good from an overall perspective. See, we often consider these kind of treatments or even things like amputation or surgeries, we consider them as necessary and good because we are able to view our body holistically. We don't view ourselves, I mean the body, as a number of individual cells or a number of individual tissues, a number of individual organs, you know. I cannot say that, I will never say that, that part of the leg is gangrenous, let's amputate it. When the doctor says that, we will never respond by saying, but what about the rights of the leg? The leg has a right to live. What if the leg living is going to cause death to the entire body? That is why we decide, I'm able to see a holistic picture and I say, yes, amputate the leg. It's fine. The leg is amputated and I live without the leg. It's a loss. It's not that things go on as normal. It is a loss, but it's a loss that I'm bearing because of my higher wisdom. Otherwise, if I try to keep the leg, the whole body will turn gangrenous and it will lead to the death of the entire body. So, because of this unconscious, automatic, holistic view, I am able to take decisions that are right. But somehow this kind of wisdom doesn't come when we think of the world. We stop our holistic view at the level of the individual itself. We agree that cells come together to form the tissue, tissues come together to form the organ, organs come together to form the organ systems, different organ systems come together to form the individual. But we think that's where the hierarchy ends. Why can't it be possible that different beings come together to form the biosphere, different biospheres, they come together to form the ecosphere, they all come together to form the system, and all the different systems come together to form the universe. And that universe is actually one whole, you know. If we are able to have that holistic kind of vision, then I will realize that whatever is happening now in the perfect moment is perfect. As an individual cell, radiation therapy may be bad for me, but from the body point of view, it's the perfect thing that's happening. As individuals, as communities, as societies, things might be seeming wrong from that narrow perspective, as an individual, as a community, or as a society. But from a holistic point of view, if we are able to take that, everything is happening in perfect harmony. And that is why Swami says that you have to study the human body itself. You know, that is one of the interpretations that Swami says of proper study of mankind is man. Study the body itself. Swami gives many examples of the functioning of the human body, and he says, study the body itself, you will understand mankind better, because that is how it functions. We need to have this holistic vision.
Right. In fact, there's this beautiful quote where Swami explains this. This again is from a discourse in 1973, the 17th of March, where Swami says, "Man has to feel himself a limb of society into which he has been born and which has fostered him and fed him with ideals and ideas. Spiritual life is not isolated existence. Man has to sow the seeds of love in his heart and harvest peace. He should share the peace with all." You know, this particular interpretation of the statement, the proper study of mankind is man has to understand himself to be a limb in society, just like, you know, how an organ is a part of him or a limb is a part of his body. It has a historical context to it, because in the 17th century was the time when, you know, the beginning of scientific exploration was picking up steam. The Industrial Revolution was about to kick in. It was a scenario where man was looking at the forces of nature and he was rapidly getting into a phase where he was able to manipulate some of the forces of nature to benefit him. Right? That was what scientific advancement was doing. And this was going to be done at the cost of unsettling the balance in the world. And it was very important to understand that you are part of the huge jigsaw puzzle, and if you're going to move any piece in a manner which is not right, you're going to affect the whole of the setup. And I think that is why what Alexander Pope said was very, very important. He said, you cannot look at yourself as an individual and look at everything around as a means for which you can improve your own standard of living, but you have to see that where do you fit into this entire scheme of thing, at least understand little of that, and then explore, and then use whatever is around you. And very, very wise words, because today when we look back, we know that, you know, this is something which was ignored. And this is what Swami would also say, even in that clip, Swami is saying that we have neglected this study of man for a very long time. You know, what the Upanishads speak of, what the Vedanta speaks of, what all scriptural texts speak of. This has been ignored, and because of that, you know, you're, it's not wrong to be scientific, but the scientific exploration has lost a sensible base which it needed.
The translation for the word man in Sanskrit is Purusha, and we have the Purusha Suktam, which will be chanted very frequently during the Dasara week. And the Purusha Suktam is so magnificent because it says that there is only one cosmic being, nothing else exists. And it says that that cosmic being has thousands of heads, thousands of hands, and thousands of legs. And Swami beautifully explains that that cosmic being is the cosmic oneness that we should have. And the thousands of heads refers to all the heads that you see around. Swami says everybody is part of that whole. You so beautifully said that man should know his place in the entire jigsaw puzzle, you know, because unwittingly, in order to make it convenient for himself, when the pieces are moved, it results in chaos. You know, recently I've been trying to learn how to solve this Rubik's Cube. And this becomes so evident in that, you know, when you're solving the Rubik's Cube, each little cube in the Rubik's Cube has one particular position. And it has to occupy that. And while you're moving that little cube to that little position, you have to keep in mind the relative position of all the other little cubes. Because if you don't give attention to the other cubes in the Rubik cube and focus only on that one little cube which has to move to a one particular position, then you will end up with a Rubik's cube that is even more disoriented and confusing than it was originally. So, because you said that puzzle and jigsaw thing this triggered off, in the same way, man also, yes, in his quest for perfection, growth, enrichment, he should keep in mind that there is a balance and there are other components also that he has to think about. Otherwise, it's totally lost. I remember a beautiful example that Professor G. Venkatraman would often give. He would say that there are trees that produce thousands of seeds. In fact, some of them produce millions of seeds. And out of these thousands or millions of seeds, only two or three will finally manage to become another tree. And Swami, Venkatraman sir would say, what a loss, what a colossal loss of seeds. How inefficient this system is. But then he would say, but that inefficiency is purposely built into the system because Because there are those ants that depend on those seeds for their survival. Without those seeds, this ant will die out. There are birds that eat the seeds. And when the birds eat the seeds, those birds are preyed upon by bigger birds. Those seeds are actually supporting an entire ecosystem. And therefore, though it will, from a human narrow perspective, it will feel that it can be the most economical and best way in order to produce just 10 seeds. Because after all, you want only 2 trees to come. That is the tree's objective. Produce only 10 seeds and protect them so well. Just ensure that nothing can penetrate it. Build thorns around it, put poison around it, nothing, so that the seed can germinate. And Professor G. Venkatraman would conclude by saying, nature is wise. That is why it chooses harmony over efficiency. That is one thing that man today has forgotten. Choosing efficiency over harmony. We see our human body also, though the human bodies are efficient systems, there are many ways, many places where efficiency can be improved. But when that efficiency improvement is coming at the cost of harmony between the organ systems, organs or even cells and tissues, it lets go of that efficiency. There is no need for any increase in efficiency at the cost of harmony, because harmony is the most important. And I think that is a beautiful interpretation that Swami gives of this statement that we need to learn and put into practice in our daily lives.
Even as you were talking about the inefficiency being built into the system, actually that is what makes the system infinitely efficient in that sense, right? Mm-hmm. It does not sustain only itself, but it's able to sustain that entire ecosystem around it. And in fact, precisely how Swami used to function in many of the ways, if you look at it, mm-hmm. what Ruchester used to tell us, I think he's narrated it even in Swami's presence, mm-hmm. of how one Swami comes and tells him that Swami would send these boys out to do shopping in Kodaikanal whenever you take them.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the boys comes back with this very nice looking shawl, which he bought from one of the Tibetan shops. So Swami calls Ruchesa and says that, hey, this shawl looks nice. Go and get 200 of these shawls. We'll take it to Bharti with us and any distribution I can do there. So Ruchesa goes to one of these shops and he asks him how much is the thing. And he told a price which Ruchesa felt that was not the right price. And he said, no, I want 200.
He felt it is costly.
Yeah, it was a little costly. So he said, I want 200 of these pieces. How much will you charge me?
Mm.
And that shopkeeper said it'll be a little more costly then. Usually if you buy in bulk, they'll reduce the price. But this man was saying, no, it'll be a little more. I'll charge you 10 rupees more.
Hmm.
So he said, you know, this is like a very, very poor business tactic. How can it become costlier? He said, no, see, if I don't sell it to you, over the period of time, as we go into the peak of the winter vacation season, the prices of these shawls I get more for these shawls. So in the beginning of the season, I'm going to sell it to you. So which means for the rest of the season, I'll not have anything to sell.
Hmm.
So he said, this is a very different kind of logic, but it doesn't work for me.
Hmm.
So he decided to track where these shawls are coming from. So he realized that it is coming from one particular factory in Madurai. And he found that buying it from there is going to cut the cost by very, very immensely.
Hmm.
In spite of the cost that he would have to put in for the travel up and down and all that.
Hmm.
So he was very happy that he had figured all this out. So he went back to Swami and then Swami asked him in the evening, what happened? Did you buy those shawls? So he laid out this entire plan of his. He said, Swami, this is what it is. And, you know, I know where to procure it from. I've already told this person who comes from Madurai every other day. So he said he'll get. And then he said that day he got the worst blasting he could ever get from Swami. You know, Swami was so upset with him. And Swami said, you have any idea what you're doing? He said, see, these are all Tibetan people. They're all refugees who have come here. And these 2 months are the only time they make their money. Right, and you're snatching their food away from their plate.
Mm-hmm.
That's like supposed to be a very rude accusation to make. And he said, no, Swami, but you know, this is what it is. The price is so much. He said, so what? You know, they will all prosper because of that. If we are able to spend a little more, they are going to prosper because of that. And you should not deny them that opportunity. You're denying them the opportunity to lead a righteous life.
Mm.
Swami said, see, they're doing the right thing. It's their business. So you're not supposed to do this. And in fact, this was a scene which would happen so many times in Kodaikanal. Even the first batch of Kodaikanal, Swami tells the boys, you go and buy hats from one of the boys who's selling on the road.
Mm.
And Swami tells them strictly no bargaining with him. Whatever price he says, you have to give. And then Swami also tells a price, I think. You know, he'll charge about 80 rupees or something. Don't give him any less. So they went there and this boy actually saw this entire group of people coming. He thought it's going to be a good business day. So he lowered his price And the boy said, no, you should take some more for it. And they gave him extra money. Because they knew that, you know, Swami's idea was this. That Swami was telling later in Kodaikanal, you know, that boy did not have food yesterday because he has not sold enough. Right? So that is actually how Swami works. That is how God's plan is. It is to provide for each one. It is not about efficiency. It is not about accuracy of, you know, how well one individual progresses in that entire scheme of things. And that is why, as mankind, to be able to understand our role better, we should understand to an extent from where it all comes in that sense.
You know, continuing from where you left off, if we actually study many of the systems in Prashanthi Nilayam, I don't think they're perfectly efficient. And it is not as if this inefficiency has crept in after the physical departure of Swami. Even in Swami's physical presence, even in the omnipresence, with his knowledge, Swami allowed some inefficiencies, because it is not as if Swami appreciated inefficiency, but for Swami, as you know, you said it, and as people have discovered it over and over again, what is more important than efficiency is harmony. And you know, it is the same creator of Prashanthi Nilayam who is the creator of the universe. So natural it is that harmony is given precedence over efficiency. If we look at our own Radio Sai, for instance, there are different staff members working in different departments. How many are actually trained or, you know, perfected in that department that they are working in? There are, of course, some who have received training, and there are people who are skilled and talented in certain fields, but it is not the most efficient. I mean, this is possibly not the most efficiently running studio in terms of the human resources, because you can get better editors, you can get better radio jockeys, you can get better website designers, and yet Swami stuck to these. In fact, on one occasion, Swami mentioned it to some of the higher-ups and the biggies in the interview room, that whatever my students can do, that's enough for me. I don't want more. When it was suggested that more efficiency, more productivity, and all this can be brought in by bringing in experts in those respective fields, Swami said, no, whatever my students do, I am happy with that. And definitely, it is Bhagwan's love for us. But from a, you know, overall point of view, if we look at it, it is Bhagwan's importance to harmony. After all, it is Radio Sai Global Harmony. It is importance that is being given to harmony over efficiency. And as you rightly said, if we see Swami's life in different instances, in different experiences, and in different decisions that he has taken as an administrator, as a chancellor, as a person who is running the hospital, it is all boiling down to only this, about harmony over efficiency. One more little example that comes to my mind is, you know, when the hospital was also started, I heard this from Rajiv Mahajan sir.
Mm-hmm.
He was saying that there was a discussion in which they were asking Swami that, Swami, you are starting a free hospital, let us keep it free for the poor, but why don't we charge from those who are able to afford it, you know, those who are rich, those who are not poor. And Swami said, nothing doing. Swami said, no, it is free for all, irrespective of caste, creed, wealth, water, irrespective of anything, it is going to be free for all. That's all it is. And there was no changing Swami's mind. And you know, later they were expressing that the wisdom that Swami had, you know, that Swami has. When you say that we'll make it free only for the poor, how do you decide who is poor? You know, I was just thinking, if a need arises wherein somebody in my family, somebody whom I know, or me, I need to receive some complex procedure from the hospital. If it's 4 lakhs, definitely I'll feel that I'm poor. I'll feel that I can't afford that 4 lakhs. Compared to a person in the village who is not having even 10,000 as life savings, he will also feel he's poor. He won't be able to afford it. Yes, I am relatively much better off than him. But still, when it comes to this treatment, I feel that I am poor. Because finally, whether we accept it or not, richness and poorness has got to do with the level of contentment that we have in life. A very rich person in terms of bank balance, if there is no contentment, will still not be very generous. We will see, it is not as if the most generous people when it comes to money are the ones who have the most big bank balances. Because generosity directly depends on whether you feel you are poor or rich, and whether you feel you are poor or rich doesn't depend on your bank balance, it depends on your contentment. That's why Swami would say, the content man is the richest one, and the one with the maximum desires is the poorest one in the world. And that's why, you know, there also Swami chose harmony over efficiency. To run a hospital entirely on donations, it would have definitely been more efficient to charge those who are able to pay. Those who can afford, pay. Those who can't, we will do free. In fact, that is a model that many hospitals, many charitable hospitals around the world adopt. But when it comes to God, that is the most perfect system. Swami chose harmony over efficiency. Now what's happening? Those who actually feel that they can afford, out of gratitude for the wonderful service rendered, they possibly come and make a donation. That's a different story. But those who feel that they can't afford, they feel grateful to Swami, they feel grateful to society, and leave it at that. So even in that case, you know, in any case that we look at Swami, Swami always has chosen harmony over efficiency. Maintaining that harmony, let's try to bring in as much efficiency as possible. But if bringing efficiency is going to cause the harmony, let's do away with the efficiency. Let's keep harmony.
And that is in the sense of looking at, you know, man's purpose in the physical reality that he is living in. As we said, this is just one level of understanding the statement. And one of the ways in which Swami quotes this particular statement and speaks about in his discourses, we'll take a short break, dear listeners, at this point. Don't go away. We'll come back and we will speak a little more about the statement, maybe take it to one more level. And we will see how much we can cover in the next half hour after this.
Something's watching you. Something's loving you. It's not far. It's who you really are. It was there at your birth. It was there as you grew. It's not far. It's who you really are. It was there when you laughed. It was there when you cried. Not far, it's who you really are. Something's giving you joy. Something's giving peace. It's not far. It's more solid than steel, and it's lighter than air. It's not far, it's who you really are. Something gives life to all. Everything. It's not far, it's who you really are. It's smaller than the smallest. It's beyond everywhere. It's not far. Something contains the earth. Something holds the universe. It's not far. It's who you really are. Something's breathing your your prayer. Something beats your heart. It's not far. It's who you really are. He's not far. He's the Psi Avatar. He's not
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are discussing a very beautiful statement of Swami, the proper study of mankind is man, a statement which we've struggled to understand for a long time, thanks to some of the people who have written to us asking that if we could discuss on this theme, and that's why we took it up, and we're grateful for the suggestion because it has enabled us to understand this statement better too. So as we've seen so far, one of the basic understandings of this statement is that one should try to understand oneself better first, and that should become the basis of all other explorations that man takes up in his life. And that's why it has to start with the understanding of oneself. And one of the ways in which that can be done is to understand one's existence in relationship to the world around. And that's what we spoke about, of how man has to consider himself as a limb of society. And that leads to a very, very important way in which he can harmonize his existence with the world around.
I'm reminded of a chinna katha that Swami would narrate. There was a father who gave his child a world map, but it was not just a world map as such. He had actually torn it into bits, and it was like a puzzle piece, and he told his child that you assemble the world, this is the world map, let me see how good your knowledge of the world is. To the father's surprise, the child did it very fast, and the world map was set right, and he was amazed, and he asked his child, how is it that you were able to do it so quickly? The secret was that right behind, you know, this world map had been torn from a book, and in that book, on the other side of the page of the world map was actually the image of a person. There was a photograph of a person. And the child says that I didn't set the world right, I just set the man right. And Swami would say that you need not try to set the world right. Just set right the man. Just set right man, and world sets right by itself. You know, that is the message Swami would give through this chinna katha. It is so relevant here because when we say the proper study of mankind is man, and when we define it for our better understanding as the proper study for mankind is man, that is the reason why we have to study man. That is why we have to understand man. That is why man has to understand himself. Because once he sets right himself, everything else automatically gets set right. So that is what it is. But then when we say that we have to set right ourselves, we spoke in terms of the cells, organ tissues, organ systems and the body. It is not just physical, you know. Physically, yes, we are a part of the entire creation, but we also have to set right ourselves, meaning at a mental, psychological, metaphysical and at a spiritual level. That is what is most important, and therefore, till now we have been talking in terms of the physical world and the physical body. I think we now take a step into the mental world.
You know, there is this interaction which Swami was having with the students. I think we might have narrated this before. A beautiful explanation that Swami gave. It started off with Swami coming and asking the students that were there in that gathering. Swami said, boys, why do you think that I spend so much time with you? And Swami said, see, so much time, there are so many thousands of devotees outside, but still I'm giving you so much time. And Swami, in Swami's own words, Swami would say that he gives almost 70% of his time to the students. So Swami would say, why do you think that I'm giving you so much time? And then Swami started giving options. Swami said, do you think I'm doing this because your fathers are all very rich and they're going to support the organization that I'm running? Or do you think I'm doing all this because you will come back and support the organization I'm doing? And Swami started telling, or do you think that you're also spiritually advanced, that I'm coming and, you know, you have solicited this grace from me? And Swami said, no, none of this is the reason. And Swami very, very profoundly replied to his own question. He said, I am spending so much time with each one of you because as I am doing this, my eye is on Loka Kalyanam. So Swami said, I am looking at transforming individuals because this is what is going to lead to the overall harmony and welfare of the world. Mm-hmm. So when you're saying that apart from being the physical part of this entire creation, that emotional and mental aspect of each individual, that transformation is so important because it is with this transformation of the individual there's going to be transformation of the world. And that was the basis of everything that Swami did, whether he was speaking to an individual. As we have said many times before, you know, when you deeply look at it, you see that Swami started in hospital not to cure people, but so that people who are in that profession, doctors and paramedics, they have an opportunity to interact with Swami and get transformed.
They can get cured.
They can get cured in that
of the Bhavaroga.
Right? So everything that Swami did was so that he can touch lives individually, and because individual transformation is going to lead to Loka Kalyanam. And that is why, you know, maybe Swami started the Balvikas movement, Swami started his foray into education, because these are the ways by which you can really, you know, put it as simply as possible, catch them young and transform them, and through them, the world will be turned around.
And, you know, when we say change the world, change the world, change the world, it always comes down to how we see the world. For I am reminded of this another Chinna Katha which Swami would say, of how Krishna comes and tells Yudhishthira, the eldest of the Pandavas, go and try to find one bad man in this world. And he comes to Duryodhana, the eldest among the Kauravas, and tells him, go and find for me one good man in this world. Both have been given opposite tasks, and interestingly, both come back with the same answer. You know, Yudhishthira says, Lord, I searched the entire world. I've searched the entire kingdom, that was his entire world. However hard I searched, I couldn't find even one bad man, O Lord. If at all there is a bad man, possibly it is me. That is what Yudhishthira says. And then Duryodhana tells, having gone around the same kingdom, he tells Krishna, O Krishna, I searched the entire kingdom. However hard I searched, I couldn't find even one good man in the kingdom. If at all there is any good man, that is me. So, both were given different tasks, but both came back with the same answer because both had vastly differing attitudes. The way they would see things is so different. And that is the reason the Mahabharata war possibly ended the way it ended, with Duryodhana lying haplessly and helplessly with his thighs broken, while Yudhishthira ascended the throne of Hastinapura as the Samrat Chakravarti, as the emperor of the entire, as the monarch of the entire country. Because Swami says it all depends on the mind. In fact, here's a quote from Swami's discourse that he delivered on the 17th of March 1973 at Shimla. Swami says, man is the synthesis of all the feelings, emotions and reactions that arise in his mind. The mind is the seat of all urges, desires and thoughts. When the mind is clean, the world cognized by it will also be clean. When the mind is turbid and fiddled with fear, the world will appear miserable and depressing. Many people blame the world without knowing that the fault lies in themselves. Their thinking is crooked. Their thoughts are not wholesome. Their minds are restless because they are too full of unfulfilled desires. Rich or poor, educated or uneducated, high or low, they see the world through the glasses of their own prejudices and predilections, and they condemn or extol it in order to please themselves. So it becomes very clear that Swami says there is no problem in the srishti, it's all in the drishti.
It again goes back to that interpretation of this statement that we were saying, that the proper study of mankind is man is the collective knowledge that we have is what is going to be the way we look at this entity called man itself, right? So when you gave that beautiful example of Duryodhana and Yudhishthira, if as a collective entity, mankind thinks of man's role as one thing, and that is what is being passed on in the form of our educational system, in the form of culture, and all of that gets passed on, right? Mm. So if you look at, if the idea is that man is a physical entity, he needs to feed himself, he needs to provide for himself, that is what is going to be passed on in the culture. And that is why Swami is saying that it has to be changed in the mind. It has to be changed in the way you look at the world, the way you look at yourself and your role in the world. And that is what is going to be passed on, and that is the whole idea which will be progressed, you know, as a, you know, the overall idea of mankind which is going to be progressed in that sense.
Absolutely. And that is why it is so important that we start at the level of the mind. Perspective makes all the difference. In fact, I remember another chinnakatha. I don't know, today so many chinnakathas are popping up. Swami tells the story of a very rich nobleman, a very rich businessman who had a terrible headache and stomach problem. You know, he had indigestion of the stomach and a splitting headache, both of which would not leave him. He could afford the best of doctors. He could afford all the treatments possible, but none of the treatment helped him. None of the treatments helped him. That is when he got to know that a sannyasi, a wandering renunciant, had come into his village, into his town, and he summoned him and he said, "You are a spiritual man, you have different powers. I have one problem that is bothering me so much. That is my headache and my stomach ache. If you can do something to cure me, I will be grateful for you. I will be grateful for it." And the sannyasi examines him and then tells him that, "You know, your problem is not in your head or your stomach. It's in your eye." "What's the problem in the eye?" He says, "Because of this peculiar defect of the eye, the treatment that I'm prescribing to you is that you should not set your eyes or anything which is not green in color. Wherever, whatever you see should be only green. If for 3 months you follow my advice and you see only green stuff, you will definitely get better and cured." So the rich man has tried out every treatment possible and it has not been successful. So he is ready to try out. As they say, a drowning man clenches even at floating straws. So he is ready. He accepts the advice from the sannyasi and the sannyasi goes his way. And Swami says that this man goes about, first of all, changing the decor of his entire home. He makes it fully green. Changes his entire wardrobe. It's only green kurtas and green dhotis. Changes not only his wardrobe, his wife's wardrobe, his children's wardrobe, his servant's wardrobe. And then goes on to start getting the entire village painted green. Everything is green. The walls in the village, all the houses, everything. It's the green village. You know, I think this was one of the villages that practiced the go-green concept. Green, right? Too literally. It went green. And before the 3 months elapsed, this sannyasi comes back. And as this sannyasi is walking, he is surprised to see everything is green. He nears the house of this nobleman, this rich businessman. And the businessman immediately dispatches his servants who come running towards this holy man with 2 paint buckets, you know, filled with green color paint. Because they don't, this sannyasi is coming in his ochre robe. And that is when the sannyasi stops them, goes to the man and says, "Oh, you fool, what are you doing?" He says, "Master, you told me I should see only green and it has actually helped. My headaches have subsided, my stomach pain has reduced and it's being of a great help. And that's why, since you're not in green, I thought I should stick by your own prescription. This is what you prescribed." He says, "I prescribed that you should see only the green, but I didn't tell you to paint the town green. You could have just worn this green spectacles, you know." And the sannyasi gives him spectacles which have green glasses. He says, "Once you wear green glasses, everything will appear green." That is when he realizes his folly. And that is why, you know, Swami tells this chinnakatha and he says that you don't have to change anything outside. Change inside. Outside everything will automatically get changed. You need not paint the entire town green. Just wear green spectacles. Once you change that, everything appears green automatically. So too, the world that we are seeing is colored by what we have in our mind. That's why Swami says here, when the mind is clean, the world cognized by it will also be clean.
And this is something which Swami would say so often, that, you know, when there is so much that can be changed within your control, you know, there's your entire personality is within your control and it takes more than a lifetime to change it. And instead of doing that, we are constantly looking at the world and trying to set right whatever is there outside of us. In fact, reminds me of another beautiful analogy which Swami gave, I think, in one of the sessions he had with the Sai Sanandhi members, where he said, you know, there is this house of a hall of mirrors into which a dog enters. And we know how protective dogs are of their, you know, their,
what do you call it?
Territorial in nature. They protect the territory very ferociously. So this dog enters there and in 1 minute it sees these 4 or 5 dogs all around. And as dogs usually do, it starts barking, it starts showing its teeth ferociously. And then Swami went on to say, then what does the dog do? It starts trying to attack the other dogs. And since it's all mirrors, it pounces on the mirrors, breaks the mirrors, it breaks down, and now there are thousands of pieces of mirrors all around, and now in the place of those 5 dogs, the dog sees thousands of other dogs, and it runs out. So Swami said, see, this is how a dog reacts when it goes into a hall of mirrors. And then Swami said, what would you do if you go into a hall of mirrors? The first thing you will realize is what you're seeing is yourself. And then the next thing you will do is, if there's anything wrong with your attire or your hairstyle or something, you will correct it. Because you are absolutely aware and sure that the defect that you see is nothing but a defect of your own self, and you will correct yourself. Mm. So Swami would say, this is the difference between an animal and a man. And that's precisely what Swami is saying, that, you know, if you, each one of us have been given a lifespan of 70, 80, 90 or 100 years as the case may be, and you have so little to do with that, I mean, so little time to do
so
what
much.
You're supposed to do with that. And Swami would say, what is worthy to fill that time with is to explore your own self. And Swami would say, understand what is your body, what is this? And Swami would say that it is nothing but
a water bubble.
You know, water bubble, nothing but a collection of feces, urine, and all the matter which is going to
it's a bag.
Decay, right?
Mm, it's a bag of all these.
Right, and Swami would say, exactly like that, look at your mind. That all the flaws that you see is because, you know, just like a person wearing colored glasses, when you have, what is that beautiful statement, Swami would say, Drishti lo lopam ledu, lopam anta drishti lo ne undi. Which means all the flaw that is there is in the way you look at things, is in your own self. So that is why the proper study of mankind is man. And, you know, now it makes so much sense. Because when we listen to Swami's discourse, suddenly the statement would come, that is why the proper study of mankind is man. And we would wonder, Swami, how does that fit in?
Correct.
Because that is what Swami was saying, that this is the solution for everything. You have to study your own self. You have to understand your own self. And maybe at the risk of making this a Chinnakatha day, there's another Chinnakatha I'm reminded of. Swami was saying that there are, you know, there are 10 people who get into a boat and they're trying to cross a river and then they're trying to cross a forest. So every now and then, you know, they tell themselves that none of us should get lost. So we are 10 of us. We should ensure that when we reach the destination, we are 10. So they finally cross this river and cross the forest and reach the destination. So the leader of the group says, okay, I'll now count and we'll ensure that all of us have reached. So then he counts and he finds that there are only 9 people. And then he starts bemoaning. He says, we have lost one of our comrades. And then the others say, who's that person? They look around. They're not able to, you know, find out who's the one person who's missing. And Swami says, each one of the members in the group start counting and each one only counts 9. And he says, yes, we have lost one person. And Swami says, they're all being so stupid because they're not counting themselves. Mm. So Swami says, that is the fundamental mistake that you do. You're trying to see who's around, trying to find out who's around and everything else. First, you have to start the counting with yourself. The knowing should start with knowing yourself.
And if you are able to
proper study of mankind is man.
and if you study yourself, you will be saved of so much of pain and grief.
Right.
That is what it is. Dear listeners, we went through a few discourse. We went through a discourse clip. We also went through a few discourse excerpts that we read out. Each of those excerpts are from those discourses where Swami, just before that excerpt or just after that, has stated the statement, the proper study of mankind is man. There are many more discourses with excerpts where Swami says this, and it only means that there are other angles to view this statement. The statement is like a multifaceted diamond that Bhagwan has given us, and there are different facets that we are examining. We will examine the remaining facets in the satsang next week. In the meanwhile, do write in to us with your thoughts, your feedback, because as I said, this is a multifaceted diamond, and there will be some facets that we will be missing out. It will be wonderful that you can contribute that and be part of this global satsang. We offer this segment at Swami's lotus feet with gratitude for the understanding, love and everything that he's showering on us. We will end now with a song on the other side of which you will be greeted by Brother Chandu with his segment, Love to Love.